This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This Veterans Day, there is hopeful news about spinal cord injury research. A Swiss research team describes a paralyzed monkey walking again with help from an implant connecting its brain to a device that applies electrical pulses to its spine. One researcher says it could be 10 years or less before we could offer human patients something similar as therapy. Meanwhile, other researchers have been working on similar brain control technology for upper body rehabilitation and also electrical stimulation systems without brain-computer interfaces, all for helping paralyzed people use their legs and regain other functions. A couple of those researchers join me now. Susan Harkeman is a professor of neurological surgery at the University of Louisville in Louisville, Kentucky. Welcome to Science Friday.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And Balu Ajibogi is assistant professor of biomedical engineering at Case Western Reserve University. He joins us from Cleveland. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Ajibogi.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about this new research first. Susan Harkeman, can you describe for us how the monkeys could walk again, what this brain-computer interface was?
Well, yeah, so it's been known for a long time that mammals with support to their spinal cord with stimulation or applying drugs can regain locomotion when their spinal cord is transected. In this case, they just took one pathway away, the cortical spinal pathway. That's thought to be important for movement. But what's new about this is they recorded signals from the brain and they used wireless technology to send those signals after they had cut the spinal cord and then tell the other piece of technology to send signals to help the paralyzed part of the body reactivate to step. So what they did is took some knowledge that was already known and put it together in a unique way.
Dr. Ajibogi, what excites you about this?
Well, I think the research itself is quite novel, quite interesting. As Dr. Harkeman mentioned, they're using a brain-computer interface to create stimulation or to control stimulation. It does suggest that in a person with a thoracic-level spinal cord injury, you may be able to do something similar. A lot of the technology that they used is already approved for human use. There are some caveats to the research, I believe, you know, the necessity of a brain-computer interface for restoring locomotion. But overall, I think scientifically, it's very interesting.
Now, I know that your work looks at brain interface technology, but for rehabilitating upper limbs, where does that research currently stand?
Yes, so I work in a collaboration with a number of universities around the country in a clinical trial called BrainGate. And the goal of the BrainGate clinical trial is to use brain-computer interface technology and connect it with functional electrical stimulation technology to restore hand and arm movements to persons with high-level spinal cord injury. We currently have one participant enrolled in Cleveland, and we are at this point working on connecting those two systems. Functional electrical stimulation has been around for decades. It was pioneered at Case Western by Dr. Hunter Peckham and Dr. Robert Kirsch. It actually became a commercial product in the mid-90s. There was a product available to persons with cervical level 5 spinal cord injury to restore hand grasping. We are now trying to connect that technology, that implantable technology, to an implanted brain-computer interface to restore both reaching and grasping to somebody with high cervical spinal cord injury.
Dr. Harkeimer, what's the difference between that and what you are working on?
Well, what we have been focusing on is related to the stimulation in the current paper of the human spinal cord. So we're using current technology to activate the spinal cord networks for walking, for standing, and for voluntary movement in very severely paralyzed humans. And what's very exciting is that bringing the scientists and the technology together is enabling us to make pretty significant advances in all those areas. In addition, while we've been studying walking and standing and moving voluntarily, we found that other conditions such as cardiovascular deficits, respiratory, poor blood flow, lots of other secondary conditions, bowel and bladder, seem to be positively affected by the stimulation. So this is a time where we're starting to understand the complexity of the nervous system, being able to exploit that. And if we work hand in hand with developing the technology, I think that we can see some great advances in recovery after paralysis for people with spinal cord injury. So we started out with locomotion. We're still working on that. We have been working on that for several years now, but are also branching out to many other areas that affect people with paralysis today.
Do you find, I'll ask this to both of you, do you find that these newer technologies, the fact that you can stimulate the nerve endings below the spinal cord injury, that it does might help make connections better and have them regrow back partially themselves?
Well, I think that there's not evidence that it's going to enable them to regrow, but I think that there's so much plasticity in the nervous system that it is able to take advantage of the system that still exists. And I think that was really not well understood until now. But what's important is with regeneration techniques that are also advancing, coupling these two could be extraordinary, because you wouldn't need to have a regeneration technique that would completely regenerate the nervous system. Maybe it would only need to regenerate a small percentage of fibers, and you couple it with this technology and get a pretty tremendous recovery. Mm-hmm. So I think multiple strategies together will ultimately be the answer.
Mm-hmm. And maybe I'll add to that I think that we as scientists just need to be a bit careful about some of the claims that we make. So we're obviously, this paper and the work that we're talking about is not claiming that we are fully regenerating the spinal cord. Our particular approach is to essentially circumvent the spinal cord, to basically be able to take those cortical signals that are generated in the brain, circumvent the spinal cord, and create the necessary stimulation patterns to create the same movements that would occur if the spinal cord were intact. So.
And how soon? I mentioned that there were some scientists who were saying we might see new research applied to patients within 10 years. Do you both think that's possible?
Well, I think, you know, there's many unknowns. To translate something to the human, you know, there's a lot of stakeholders who have to work together. There's a lot of unknowns. And so I think I would be really cautious in trying to put a timeline on it. But what I think is exciting about it is that there's been many scientific breakthroughs. So the path is known on how to get there. So bringing the technology that is known out there together with the scientists, I think could really accelerate that.
Mm-hmm. Two years ago, we talked to you after your team used electrical pulses in the spine to help two men move their legs voluntarily after years of paralysis. What's happened since then? Have we seen advances since then? Have you had other successes?
We have. We've now implanted 10 individuals, and we have seen very similar results in varying degrees. Both in the ability to move voluntarily and stand. So that is very positive in that we can reproduce those results. We still need, as I have mentioned several times, we need to couple that with the technology to make it useful in the home and community. So that's one of the areas of research we're working very hard on. And we also have a grant where we're looking at the cardiovascular function, and we're working towards actually doing a very large cohort of 36 patients where we will be looking at the secondary conditions, cardiovascular function, and we're hoping that that's something that might be translated pretty quickly, because we've seen results with that with the existing technology. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I mean, I think this is a very promising area that many scientific groups are working on. It is very positive, we're very excited where the path is going.
Yeah. Dr. Ajiboye, we heard about this being a breakthrough, this trial with the monkeys. because it uses wireless technology, which has to carry a lot of data for this to work, right? When you look at the future of the brain-computer interfaces, what do we still need to improve on here?
Well, so first and foremost, I think the wireless technology is a breakthrough, and it is necessary for clinical translation. In our current clinical trial, participants have a percutaneous pedestal, or a pedestal which goes through the skull, and they are connected to our recording devices. For them to be able to use these systems on a regular basis, we need a system which allows us to perform 24/7 recording, and that's wireless. So that's definitely a breakthrough. There needs to be a number of technological advances in terms of the interface. We need to make sure that the interfaces are robust, that they're able to outlive the patients, they're able to record high fidelity and robust neural signals for long periods of time so that, you know, just like they did in the paper, we can have confidence in the information that we extract from the neural signals related to movement. Mm-hmm. We also need the ability to record from large numbers of neurons. Most of the current work, you know, my work included, the work in the paper, are fairly limited in terms of the number of neurons you're able to record from simultaneously. We need to be able to record, I believe, from thousands, tens of thousands of neurons simultaneously, so that we can begin to think about controlling high-dimensional systems. So in the case of reaching and grasping, to be able to control the shoulder, the elbow, right, the hand, right, the wrist, all the fingers together, we need high-dimensional systems, high-dimensional recordings that allow us to control these high-dimensional systems.
Dr. Balu Ajiboye, Assistant Professor of Biomedical Engineering at Case Western Reserve. Dr. Susan Harkema, Professor of Neurological Surgery at the University of Louisville. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend.
Thank you very much.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Last year, the international community, including the United States, came together to discuss and sign the Paris Climate Agreement. It was a global acknowledgement to tackle climate change. President-elect Donald Trump has vowed to pull out of that agreement. What will a Trump administration mean for the environment and climate change policies? Can we look to the private sector to innovate solutions? My next guest is a longtime energy and environment reporter. He attended those talks in Paris, and he's here to give us some perspective. David Biello is author of the new book, The Unnatural World, The Race to Remake Civilization in Earth's Newest Age. And if you want to read an excerpt from it, it's up there on our website at sciencefriday.com/unnatural. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
I know that we really don't know what Donald Trump is going to do because he changes his position a whole lot every day almost. The Paris Climate Agreement, a big change story. What do you think that he might pull us out of that agreement?
Well, I mean, the only thing Donald Trump has been consistent on is his inconsistency. So like you said, we really don't know. However, his statements so far would lead one to believe that yes, he will attempt to pull us out of the Paris Climate Accord. He can't do it directly. The agreement was kind of structured in such a way to prevent that kind of outcome. That said, most of the commitments under the Paris Agreement are voluntary, so he can just fail to fulfill them. And based on his appointments to the EPA so far, the man who is heading his transition team is a longtime climate denier. And
who's that?
Myron Ebell, somebody who I've interviewed many times in the past. He comes from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He's about as climate skeptic as they come, pretty suave about it. So not your run-of-the-mill climate skeptic. But that's the person who's leading the transition at the EPA, and that would lead one to believe that Donald Trump meant what he said and is going to act not act on climate change.
Our number 844-724-8255, talking with David Biello, author of The Unnatural World. President Obama passed the Clean Power Plan to reduce carbon pollution from power plants. Mr. Trump said that, you know, he wants to bring coal back. I mean, do we believe him on that? Is it possible? I mean, there are companies that just have gone bankrupt, companies.
Yeah. Well, he is certainly capable of overturning the Clean Power Plan, particularly if he if Myron and his other minions kind of gut the EPA, then the Clean Power Plan will kind of die with them. That said, there are economic trends that even Donald Trump can't control, one of which is we have a lot of cheap natural gas. And that's really what killed coal, not not Obama administration regulations or anything else. And that trend is going to continue because Donald Trump has also said that he wants to drill for all of America's abundant fossil fuel resources. That would presumably include natural gas. Natural gas will stay cheap and coal will stay dead.
Of course, so we're just speculating because we don't know what he really...
That is true.
What he really would do. One of the agencies that have acknowledged climate change is the Department of Defense. In fact, I remember the DOD said this is like, you know, national security issue. Could you not use that if you want to do something? Could you not say, hey, I'm going to pass it off because it's a DOD imperative that we do something about climate.
Absolutely. And certainly I would suggest that the Department of Defense is going to proceed on that front regardless. They have their own kind of intrinsic reasons for wanting to act on climate change. They aren't necessarily tied to acting on climate change. They have to do with energy security at military bases, getting themselves off foreign oil. If the Air Force wants to scramble jets, they don't want to have to rely on Saudi Arabia to fuel them. So those trends are going to continue regardless of who's in power. And that means that at least some action on climate change will continue.
Yeah, because we've had the Secretary of the Navy on the show talking about how green they have become. You would think that you can't turn these things around, I would think.
You cannot turn them around entirely. And like I said, there are kind of intrinsic reasons why the military would want to take these actions. That said, you can certainly slow them down via your funding choices.
Getting back to the EPA, do you think you can just do away with the whole EPA, clean air, clean water? Or do you think it's just parts that go away? Or do you think the whole thing could go away?
Well, it's enshrined in law. They would have to make a very concerted effort to get rid of the Environmental Protection Agency entirely. That would probably be the kind of consistent regulatory effort that perhaps Donald Trump doesn't have the consistency for. But in the shorter term, they can certainly gut it and ensure that the EPA does not act as kind of a strong regulator, but is a little bit more of a rubber stamp for greater pollution.
What about the Senate? Does it have any control over any of these things that might happen?
Well, absolutely. Congress has the power of the purse, but Congress is also in Republican hands. So, you know, they're going to decide what their funding priorities are, and wherever the dollars flow, that's where the action is going to take place.
Mm-hmm. Are China and other countries looking toward us about their climate policy? You know, they had the Paris Agreement. They all signed on to it. If they see us pull out, does that give them cover to pull out also?
Absolutely. Now, that said, I do think that just as the U.S. military is acting on climate for its own intrinsic reasons, countries like China and India are acting on climate for their own intrinsic reasons. China is suffering through horrific air pollution, and acting on climate is one way for them to address that. They are extremely concerned about drought as one of the possible impacts from climate change, and so they're going to act on climate regardless. That said, all the international pressure on them to act will have essentially evaporated. Only the European Union will remain as kind of a you know, international goad for climate
action.
But
as you say, for all of us, I've been to China, I've seen the horrid pollution they have. It's in their own interest, right?
Exactly.
They don't have to do it because we do it. They want to take care of their own population.
Exactly. And frankly, the Communist Party views it as a threat to stability. So they're going to act on it. There's no question about that. That said, they're not going to act on it as fast or kind of to the same scale if without the pressure, the additional pressure provided by the United States and, frankly, our cooperation in kind of technology transfer and all the rest of it. And that is where maybe there's hope from a Trump administration. They're interested in kind of American prosperity. There are a lot of jobs in installing solar panels. There are a lot of jobs in wind turbines. Perhaps
sure.
They will pursue those.
Well, you know, you go to Iowa and you see how they, per capita, they are leading the country in you know, wind power.
Exactly.
How do you go back to Iowa and say, I don't want, you know, to keep this thing up?
You can't do it. So I don't think that will happen. And, you know, the states are going to be leading the charge on this. And frankly, a lot of the people who voted to elect Donald Trump are the most passionate advocates for things like solar power because kind of like the military, they enjoy that idea of energy independence, that I'm kind of free of my utility because I have solar panels on my roof. Solar is kind of a bipartisan, attractive power source, and that's not going away either.
Mm-hmm. You would think that if you wanted to have it always, you could invest in these green energies because it is good for business and people like it, and it might be a way of uniting all different kinds of people. Do you think that might happen?
One can hope.
You're not very optimistic about this.
Well, I mean, with Myron Ebell and some of the other appointments that seem to be being made, it's not the change in Washington, D.C. that I think people voted for. It's kind of the old stale ideas that we saw in the 1990s are now resurgent.
Well, do you see then us losing money for research in the sciences, and especially sciences that have to do with the environment?
Quite possibly.
Green energy, things like that.
I mean, if you read Trump's contract with voters, it explicitly wants to transfer money from environmental programs to infrastructure improvements. Now, depending on what those infrastructure improvements might be, that could be a good thing or a bad thing.
Let's go to the phones. Our number 844-724-8255. Deborah in Brown Deer, Wisconsin, you're up first today. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, Ira and guest. I really feel Donald Trump is not educated, and it doesn't take a lot of reading or thinking to figure out that the effect humans living on a planet and using up the natural resources are having an effect on it. I think it's a no-brainer, and I think he's, now that he's president, he'll be more accountable and step up to the plate. At least I hope so.
So you think he might change his mind, or the president, as Werner Herzog told us, the office might shape him?
That's what, you know, when he said that, when Werner said that, I had just been thinking that. That's my best hope, that I have a saying, bad things are good things in disguise, and this just might be one of them.
All right, Deborah, thanks, and have a good holiday weekend. Thanks for calling. Yeah, there is, you know, as you say, we really don't know.
That is the hope.
What the future is, environmentally speaking. Where would you look for a first sign that something might be different than what the way he's been talking during the campaign?
The first sign is obviously these appointments, but the second sign would be who actually ends up in charge. It doesn't seem that the Trump team had a lot of plans for post-election, and so they're kind of scrambling a little bit to get some transition in place. The people who end up in place will determine, whether there's hope or not. And mm-hmm. some of the statements that I think President-elect Trump will make in coming days will tell us, what does he really believe, if anything.
You know, when we signed you up to come on the program to talk about your book, The Unnatural World, we had no idea we'd be talking.
Yes.
But this is, as a lot of people different didn't. But let's talk about the book. And it's subtitled, The Race to Remake Civilization in Earth's Newest Age. What does that mean?
Well, we're talking about kind of this effort, this global effort to bring human impacts kind of more into line with the standing of the environment. And, mm-hmm. Obviously electing Donald Trump seems to have set that back. And perhaps we put the man into Anthropocene again. Mm-hmm. Old white men are in charge again. But, there's still hope. We're in a race. It's a long haul. It's not over.
There's a long way to go.
Never time to stop, right?
Let's go to Fayetteville, Arkansas. Melissa, hi. Welcome to Science Friday, Melissa.
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Well, I just wanted to make a comment on the observation that your speaker made earlier about how solar PV, it tends to be a crossover sector. And my husband and I own a small solar company. And our clients tend to be less motivated by politics and more by the sense of that independence that your guests spoke of. and that sense of being able to grow your own energy, so to speak. And so I think that there's a lot of hope. And so that's all I wanted to say.
Okay, there you go. It's some nice hopeful words for this holiday weekend on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flatow here with David Biello, author of The Unnatural World, The Race to Remake Civilization in Earth's Newest Age. We have a little bit of an excerpt of that book on our website, sciencefriday.com/unnatural. So there was some if you want to find a way, you can find some sort of compromise if you want to.
Yes, and I think some of these trends are unstoppable no matter who's in office. I mean, honestly, as the Obama administration showed, the presidency only has so much power. There's only so much that Trump can do. Yes, he can do some harm, but he could also end up doing some good. And perhaps this is kind of the last gasp of an old way of thinking, and will spur greater change and innovation in the future.
Speaking of innovation, I'm glad you brought that back up. What specific innovations do you see in your book that could be on the horizon?
Well, clearly we're going to need better technologies to cope with carbon dioxide if the Trump agenda bears out. If we do end up burning more coal, more natural gas, more oil, we're going to have to figure out a way to take that CO2 back out of the sky. That could be plants. They already do it, but they can only do so much. So we could turn to kind of farming the ocean as one way of pulling CO2 out of the sky. Or we can build machines that can do the job for us. These technologies exist. We could employ them. We could put money into their research and development because we're going to need them.
Does carbon sequestration, is that part of it? Does it work? Has it been proven yet?
We have the technology, as the saying goes. It's just too expensive. So if we make a concerted effort on R&D and put money into it, if Trump really believes in clean coal, as he said on the campaign trail, we can make that a reality. And frankly, that would be a great thing because China needs it. India needs it. They burn more coal than we do. And the whole world needs that clean coal technology.
If you wanted to put people back to work, they're very easy green jobs and green technologies and green research.
Exactly.
You could sink the money into.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
What if we lined that big wall he's going to make with solar panels?
It's in the desert. It's in the desert. It's pretty sunny.
You call Elon Musk and say, put those shingles on the whole wall.
Yeah.
But that kind of idea, though, people are saying it could be $25 billion to build a wall if it ever gets built.
Right.
You could be spending that money into creating jobs and clean energy jobs.
Exactly. And, quite frankly, the wall, in addition to being a humanitarian disaster, would be an ecological disaster. So it's not the best idea. But that said, if we can unite around some ideas that are maybe a little bit better, like solar PV, which seems to cut across party lines and voter affiliations, then there is still hope.
Mm-hmm. So we'll take some glass half full, maybe. Yeah, but as we said 3-4 times already, we have no idea how this is going to shake out, who's going to be in charge, who's going to run the EPA, and about the National Science Foundation. How much money will that get? That's important.
And how interested Trump is in any of this. It may be that he is not going to make any decisions in this area and kind of outsource that to other people. Or it's possible that he cares about this deeply on some level that we're not aware of we'll implement whatever his own agenda is.
Well, we'll take a solace that he does come from New York, where we're sitting, and we have lots of big ideas here. Thank you, David, and good luck with the book.
Thank you.
David Biello, author of the new book, The Unnatural World, The Race to Remake Civilization in Earth's Newest Age. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. On Monday, the moon is having, as they say in Hollywood, its close-up. So close that the moon will be 14% brighter than usual. And not only will the moon appear bigger and brighter, the Steadfast satellite will be the closest it's ever been to Earth in nearly 80 years. It's widely believed that the moon was created when a Mars-sized body smashed into the Earth billions of years ago and ripped away enough material to form it. But something about how the Earth and the moon are locked in their orbital dance suggests that there's something missing from this theory. And now a team of researchers thinks it has an answer, published now in the journal Nature. Sarah Stewart is one of the researchers. He's also a professor of planetary sciences at UC Davis. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you.
The giant impact theory, the idea that the moon came from something colliding with the Earth, it's been around for a while. What doesn't that explain?
The giant impact theory tries to explain the large size of our moon compared to the Earth and the chemical similarity between the Earth and the moon. And a key feature of the original theory was that it also set the current length of day on the Earth. But as scientists looked into the theory, the details of the chemistry of the moon and the orbit of the moon didn't match the original model of a Mars-sized object hitting the Earth.
So instead, how has your idea updated what we should be thinking?
So we turned the giant impact theory on its head a little bit and changed all of the details about the impact. Instead of having a Mars-sized body, we ask for the impact to deliver a lot of energy, enough energy to mostly vaporize the Earth. In addition, we want the impact to give the Earth more spin so that it would spin about twice as quickly just after the moon formed compared to the original theory. And then the new kicker in this paper is that we start with the Earth tilted way over so that its tilt from the orbit of all the planets is somewhere between 60 and 80 degrees instead of the 23 degrees that we see today.
So the impact smacked the Earth and put it back up to where it is today from basically being sideways to a little more horizontal?
We're proposing that the impact put the Earth sideways, and the paper explains how to get it back to where it is today.
Uh-huh. And how do you model this to come out the way it is in your paper?
So Matya Chuk, the lead author, wrote a computer code to model the details of the orbit of the moon with time. And when you start with the Earth tilted over and the moon forming in the Earth's equator, normal tides like what we have today move the moon further and further away from the Earth. And at about 20 times Earth radius from the Earth, the moon starts to feel the sun's gravity pull more than the Earth's gravity pull. And in that transition, there's a resonance between the Earth, the moon, and the sun that tilts the Earth back up, but leaves the moon's orbit tilted more than 30 degrees from the ecliptic plane.
But
that's not where we see the moon today.
Uh-huh.
So the moon today is tilted only 5 degrees from the plane, but in the standard model, the moon should have no tilt compared to the orbit of all the planets, and the tilt of 5 degrees was a big puzzle in the original theory. So in our new model, after the first big transition where the moon is left at a 30-degree tilt or more, there's a second transition at about 30 Earth radii, about half the distance that the moon is from the Earth today. And in that transition, the orientation of the moon changes and the tilt of the orbit is lowered to be consistent with where we are today.
Mm-hmm. How much of a change in the cataclysmic first impact do you have to make for this to happen?
We basically changed everything. The only thing that's the same are the words giant impact. And we've made it 10 times more energetic, twice as much angular momentum, which gives us the length of day. And we've tilted the planet way over compared to the original model.
So do you have to look for new evidence to back up the theory? Or are you saying, you know, the evidence we have is more in line with what we think now?
So we would say that this model is the first model that explains these key features about our system. And there are other competing models out there, but none of the pieces all hang together to be consistent with all of the data that we have. That's not a proof that our model is correct. It means that we think we're going in the right direction, and we are looking for tests in the model. And one of the tests is to look at the thermal history of the Earth and the Moon, because these events that change the whole orientation of the system deposit heat in the Earth and the Moon, and that's something we can look for in the rock record.
When the Earth and the Moon were really, really close after the collision, how much heat does that leave over in the Earth? I mean, just the tidal forces would also heat the Earth up, would they not?
Yes, Earth's early history was very interesting. It wasn't hospitable at all. there about 10% of the rock of the Earth was actually rock vapor, and it extended all the way out to where we think the moon formed. So the Earth itself was several times bigger, and if you could see it just after the impact, it would be this huge ball of rock gas glowing like lava glows, and the moon would be forming from this vapor. And if it's tilted over, the seasons would be completely different, and that early tidal evolution would have kept the Earth hot, and it would have taken longer to cool.
Hot enough to boil the oceans?
The oceans, there were no oceans.
No oceans, then.
There were no oceans, so the rock and the water would all be gas mixed into a big, thick atmosphere around the Earth.
Wow. Now, I understand that after you figure out all the math for all of this stuff that you have, you also have a lab where you can physically test out these ideas by shooting particles at each other, dust particles?
Yes, I have what's called a gas gun lab. And if you imagine a couple of cannons, we launch small bullets at planetary materials and study what happens when they are subjected to the high pressures and temperatures during planet formation. And in our lab, we can reach impact velocities of about 8 kilometers per second. And that's how fast the space shuttle had to go to get into orbit.
Wow. So you can reproduce these impacts.
We can now, in laboratory facilities, in my lab and others, reach all of the pressure and temperature conditions during planet formation.
All right. So let me ask you then, because I am very fascinated. We're going to have this big moon coming up. What's your favorite part of that story, the big moon story?
Well, I like to run, and I love seeing the moon up in the sky, and it is so much bigger when it's at perigee. You mentioned that it was 14% bigger in diameter. That's 30% bigger in area. So if you've been glancing up at the moon when you've been out and about, it really is bigger than it normally is, and it makes a beautiful view at sunset with this coming up supermoon on Monday.
Wow. Well, how come we only have one moon?
Ah, remember when I said the moon was unusually large compared to other moons around other planets? Our moon tends to be a bit of a bully, and there could have been other moons early in Earth's history, but the dynamical interactions between them and our moon and the Earth would have led to their demise.
Let me end our conversation by getting back to the big moon coming up on Tuesday. What's the best way to see it?
So at sunset, in most places, you'll be able to see that it's really big, but it is at its fullest just before dawn on the west coast. And so you'll look early morning or just before you go to bed Sunday night.
Hmm. Is it going to be a full moon?
It will be a full. So the supermoon is the coincidence of a full moon and the moon's closest approach in its orbit. Its orbit is not a perfect circle, but a little bit of an ellipse. And so when the full moon is aligned with its closest approach, it can appear 30% larger than at other points in its orbit.
Cannot wait. Thank you for...
It'll be gorgeous.
Yeah, that's great. I always love talking about the moon. And thank you for your research, and good luck.
Thank you.
Sarah Stewart, Professor of Planetary Sciences at the University of California at Davis. There's been a lot of talk about sending a manned mission to Mars. And earlier this fall, Elon Musk unveiled his designs for a two-stage transport vehicle. NASA is developing its own system to reach the planet by the 2030s. But what happens when the crew gets there? How will they communicate with mission control on Earth? What kind of experiments will they conduct? Is it going to be like The Martian, just like the movie? Well, NASA is testing out these questions in an area that's similar to Mars, and that is at the base of a volcano in Hawaii. Science Friday's senior producer Christopher Intagliata is out in the field with the researchers at this lava flow in Hawaii. Tough job. Somebody had to do it. And he's here to check in about what he's seen this week. What's going on, Christopher?
Hey, Ira. How's it going?
How's it going there? Let's talk about it. Are you hanging out on the beach? What are you seeing there?
You know, I guarantee you I haven't set foot on a beach while I'm here. This part of Hawaii is not the palm trees and the white sandy beaches that you might see on the postcards. This is a very actively geologic area, and the scenery is different. There's miles and miles of lava beds. You have hot steam coming out of the lava beds. The ground's even warm. You have to be careful where you sit. There's even a bubbling lava lake up the road with bubbles as big as Volkswagens exploding and splashing lava. So very different from the sandy beaches.
Hmm. And so you've been collecting sounds from what you're seeing out there.
I have, yeah. And it turns out this area is very analogous to what young Mars was like 3 billion years ago. It's pretty wet and there's all this activity. So that's why NASA has picked it as a simulated area for a Mars mission. And they have astronauts going out on these lava beds, taking all sorts of geologic samples. The project is called BASALT, which is appropriate. They like to come up with fun acronyms. That stands for Biologic Analog Science Associated with Lava Terrains. And so I caught up with a couple of these astronauts out in the field the other day. One of them was Kara Beaton, a human spaceflight engineer at Johnson Space Center. And the other was Rick Elphick, who's a planetary scientist at NASA Ames. And here's how they describe the tension between doing science but also being on a mission.
We've got limited resources, meaning life support, time, daylight, all of those things that we track. But we also have to maintain some flexibility because when we go out in the field, we don't know exactly what we're going to find. Mm-hmm. So we want to have someone that can help us explore within some, you know, loose bounds.
It's a methodical approach to executing a mission. You know, and a scientist can easily get kind of caught up in the, ooh, that's cool, that's pretty, that's something I'd like to investigate and explore. And if you don't have the time to do it before your oxygen runs out, well, that's dumb, you know. So.
It certainly is. We're talking with Christopher Intagliata and scientists out there in Hawaii on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And Christopher, they don't want to be dumb, do they?
No.
So what kind of experiments are they testing out in that locale?
Yeah, so they're walking around the field, and they have sample sites picked out each day. And there's a whole operations team back at the Kilauea military base in the park. And that's a huge room of people. You have scientists, computer coders, operations spaceflight people. They direct them to go to these areas. They're tracking their movements. And then when the scientists get to an area they're supposed to sample, they're taking pictures, they're zapping rocks with these X-ray machines and also spectrometers. And they're kind of figuring out, if we were on Mars, what sort of instrument or, you know, X-ray gun would a real astronaut want to be carrying around in the field pack? What's the geologic tricorder that they would want to develop for that sort of trip? And it's a pretty accurate simulation, except for one detail. I was talking with Darlene Lim, who is the principal investigator on the project, the other day, and here's what she said.
A lot of times, you know, I start into the whole process of the fact that we're doing real science under simulated Mars mission conditions, and then right away I get asked, well, do you have spacesuits? Because I think that visually people just imagine that you have to have spacesuits. But what we've realized is that if you take a step back, there are so many other first principles you got to meet, questions you got to answer in terms of how do you organize people, allow data to flow, and how do you allow that data to come into a science team that is effectively, you know, hundreds of millions of miles away, as well as separated by a delay in the communication between two different groups.
Yeah, I can imagine that, because I can hardly get cell phone reception when I'm in my basement at home. So how big is this delay in the communication between Mars and Earth?
Well, that's the really fascinating part about their simulation here is during the Apollo missions, when the astronauts were on the moon, it was about just a little over a second of delay one-way communication for mission control to talk to the astronauts and then the astronauts to talk back to Earth. When we send astronauts to Mars, we're looking at anywhere from 4 to 24 minutes of delay. So they're effectively in the future doing missions, investigating the rocks, and then they're sending back things that get to Earth. You know, it could be 15 minutes later, 20 minutes later, and then the science team on Earth, you have hundreds of scientists who want to publish on this material they're collecting and who want to get scientific information. They're going to have to figure out, how do I help these astronauts that are walking around on the surface knowing that they're actually in the future for me. And everything that I'm getting is past information. So they're also working within these time constraints, figuring out what the delay is. It's kind of reimagining mission control.
Yeah. One last question for you. When you talk to these scientists, do any of them really want to be the first ones to go to Mars?
Pretty much every person I've asked would go to Mars. Yeah. With the caveat that a lot of them want to come back.
Details. Good luck to you out there. We hope you do get to the beach at least once.
Now I'm heading to the airport right now, Ira.
All right. Well, have a good and safe holiday weekend. And thanks, everybody, for us out there who helped you put this together. Christopher Taliata, who is our senior producer out there on a field trip in Hawaii at the lava flows, talking about Mars and what's going to be coming up. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And, of course, if you missed any part of the program and you want to catch up, you can always go to our website at sciencefriday.com. And as I say, we have a little bit of the book up there. If you want to read an excerpt from the book we talked about with the environment, it's up there also. And also, we leave us some email and suggestions. A lot of educational materials up there, and it gives you something to do to take your mind off the weekend. Have a great weekend, a holiday safe weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.